Tales of History and Imagination. Today's tale picks up on 18th November 1914. The setting? Shimbaberis, the tallest mountain in the African state of Somaliland. The Karif, a hot labouring wind heavy with sand, was in full force. But up in the hills that day, the air was quite pleasant. Well, actually a slight correction. The air was heavy with waves of red-hot bullets flying in around head height. While this kind of weather isn't to everyone's tastes, to one man, apparently this was paradise. On this day, with little more than a few shrubs for cover, a group of British soldiers stealthily ascended the mountain. The British had Somaliland in their sights from around 1899. The scramble for Africa was well on, and Somaliland was desirable, solely because one could attack ships travelling through the Suez Canal from there. This was a threat to Britain's trade routes. And that was reason enough for the British to conquer the Dervishes. The Dervishes' leader, Muhammad Abdullah Hassan, was a Sufi poet in peacetime. Now a freedom fighter, the press dubbed him the Mad Mullah. Neither mad nor a mullah. He was just a guy who believed his homeland was worth fighting for. The Dervishes of Somaliland would fight on till 1920, when the invaders brought planes to what was then still a gunfight. But the Dervishes aren't our protagonists today. Our hero, well okay, he's on the wrong side of this one, but bear with me, is the British officer tasked with taking out the stone blockhouse. With an unobstructed view of the valley, the blockhouse was the perfect place to launch guerrilla attacks from. Today, that would end. As the soldiers crept to within 400 yards of the building, the Dervishes unleashed a volley of gunfire. They were fighting with ancient guns, and mixing their shot low to conserve resources. So much of their volley fell shy of the target. For a moment, both sides positioned themselves and engaged in a flame war, hurling insults back and forth about the opposing side's parentage. A hero turned to his commander, Lord Ismay, and begged permission to storm the defences. It was just a 400-yard sprint, and then a 3-foot jump across an embankment. All he had to do then was burst through the front door and shoot them all dead. Lord Ismay relented. If Adrian Carton de Weert wanted to play hero, who was he to stop him? The charge started off fine, but within metres of his target, Carton de Weert felt a stinging in his left eye. Full of adrenaline, he returned fire and kept moving. But then a second bullet caught him on the elbow, and then a third glanced the side of his head, going clean through his ear. He stepped back a ways so a medic could sew his ear back up, and then re-entered the fray. But this was not to be Adrian Carton de Weert's lucky day. As he and his men finally approached the blockhouse, a ricochet glanced up at him, striking him again in the eye. This shot finally took him off his feet. As the day wore on, no one could make headway on the blockhouse. The British fell back, and an Indian battalion stepped up, but they also failed to take it. Adrian and the other walking wounded were taken down the mountain. The following morning, the British reascended Shimbaberis, only to find the Dervishes had escaped under cover of darkness. Carton de Weert was sent back to London to recuperate. Unsurprisingly, he lost the eye. He was fitted with a glass one on the insistence of the War Department, who felt sending obviously wounded men back into battle was a terrible look. But he detested the way it felt and chucked it from the taxi on his way back to the front. For the rest of his life, he wore an eye patch. Something others stated gave him the air of an elegant pirate. While most people would be depressed at the loss of an eye, Adrian was far too excited at the opportunities his injury opened up. Somaliland was a sideshow, and he was now free to take a role in the main event, the First World War in Europe. Now, I should make a quick disclaimer. We're entering a boy's own adventure tale. The author of his Happy Odyssey, the man himself. He's great at sharing tales of his battlefield injuries, which is why we now think of Adrian Carton de Weert as the unkillable soldier. He never really tallies up the other column, the many lives he presumably took personally. You don't just keep getting sent into battle like he did, unless you were really good at killing. Now, I've thought about running a chapter-by-chapter tally of kill versus injury, but as the injuries mount up, the kills will always be, we don't know. Agaveri respected his enemies enough that he found such bragging a little gross. However, I will run the occasional tally of the injury count. If nothing else, it provides a through line on an otherwise episodic tale. So our first tally, and not the first of his career, has our hero shot in the stomach and groin. We'll get back to those. Shot in the ear and twice in the eye. His kill count? We have no idea. Okay, let's head back to the beginning. Adrian Carton de Weert was born into wealth and title, although not to a terribly happy family life, on 5th of May 1880 in Brussels, Belgium. A rumour persists, and if true it could explain the family dynamic, that his real father was King Leopold II of the Belgians. Whatever the case, Adrian's father, Leon, and his mother, Ernestine, moved to Egypt when Adrian was 3. They were divorced by the time Adrian was 6. Ernestine remarried, had 2 more children, and then died suddenly, aged just 26. When Leon, a lawyer, was offered a job in London, the family moved to England. Adrian was soon packed off to an exclusive boarding school. As a foreigner, he was terribly bullied by the other kids. But he hit his stride when the other kids discovered he was a star athlete in the making. From boarding school, he moved on to Oxford University's Balliol College, where Leon intended he study law. Perhaps unsurprisingly, Adrian had no interest in law. In 1899, the Second Boer War broke out, and Adrian signed up under a false name to fight for Britain. And it was an inauspicious start. Not long after joining Paget's Horse Yeomanry Regiment in the country, he was ambushed by a group of Boers who shot him in the stomach and groin. Sent home to recover, Leon discovered the deception. And as angry as he was, Adrian convinced his father to let him sign back up under his own name. However, Leon insisted he signed up for officer training. Adrian took British citizenship, retrained, and returned to a post with the Imperial Light Horse Brigade. However, by the time he returned to South Africa, the Boer War was all but over. The extent of his killing at the tail end of the war was limited to livestock, to deprive the Boers of food. At the close of the war, he tried to get himself assigned to Somaliland. The British were already fighting the dervishes. But instead, he spent 12 years stationed with the 4th Dragoon Guards in India. From his own telling, these years were filled with hunting, sports, training, gambling, and drunken shows of machismo. On top of his wage, he had an allowance from his father, so he lived comfortably. But in January 1914, a letter arrived from his father, stating he had lost the family fortune on the stock market. His allowance was stopping immediately. This prompted Adrian to put in again for a combat role in Somaliland. In August 1914, with the outbreak of the First World War, the 4th Dragoon were sent off to fight on the Western Front, and Adrian was extremely envious of his former compatriots' good luck. However, Adrian Carton de Weert saw action on the Western Front soon enough. In February 1915, he sailed for France, at the head of his own cavalry battalion. Sent to the trenches of Flanders, the vast devastation of the trenches struck him hard. As far as one could see, the land was denuded of trees and foliage. Although quieter than Ypres, there was still plenty to worry about in Flanders. For one, they were outgunned and being ordered to ration their artillery rounds to half a dozen shells a day. From Flanders, they were deployed to Ypres, just as the Germans first unleashed chlorine gas attacks on the enemy. He seemed unworried about Fritz Haber's gas attacks, but the heavy artillery made him more than a little nervous. Something he claimed he would have found exhilarating if only his side had as many shells to lob back at the enemy. On occasion, a shell would land nearby, throwing him around like a ragdoll. One dark night, while stationed at Ypres, Adrian wandered too far into German territory. Next thing, a German soldier yelled halt at him in German, and then fired on him from close range. He was soon spread out on the ground with a badly mangled hand. The Germans continued to fire on him, and Carden de Weert got back up on his feet and fought back. He quickly made his way back to safer territory. Once back, the extent of his injury was clear. His palm and part of his wrist were blown off. Two fingers were dangling by a thread. Famously, the surgeon refused to remove those fingers, but fearing they would go gangrenous, Adrian Carden de Weert tore the fingers off himself. He was shipped back to London, to a Park Lane hospital, who came to know him very well over the course of the war. Over several operations, Adrian progressively lost his left hand. 3 weeks after the amputation, now in early 1916, Adrian was on a boat headed back to the Western Front. He was assigned to the 19th Infantry Division. On arrival, he noted an increase in ammunition at the front. Also, in a rare moment of speaking about people he'd killed, after wiping out a machine gun emplacement at the Somme, he was surprised to find the dead were already bandaged up, some already sporting horrific injuries. This war wasn't just chewing up the Allies at an alarming rate. There's a tale. On July 2nd, 1916, while posted at the Somme, Adrian Carden de Weert was called upon to clear the Germans out of the village of La Boisselle. He was in charge of the 8th Gloucester's division at the time. He mentions he didn't trust himself with a pistol at this stage, for fear he'd start shooting those in his own rank who didn't fight hard enough. So he was only armed with a walking stick. Two previous attempts to clear the village out had failed, so he knew this would be quite the struggle. On arrival, he was greeted by dozens of corpses left to rot in no man's land. Under heavy fire, the 8th Gloucester Division marched on the village. Lacking a gun, Adrian took to lobbing grenades as he went. After a day's heavy fighting, much of which he personally led from the front, the Allies took what was left of a by then heavily bombed village. The following day, the Germans shelled them relentlessly, but the 8th Gloucesters held the line. Another tale he shared of the Somme happened in the Devil's Wood. They were there on a night mission to secure the wood, when a shot rang out from out of nowhere. It dropped Carden de Weert before he could even register he'd been hit. To quote him, "We were still moving up when suddenly I found myself flat on my face, with the sensation that the whole back of my head had been blown off." Holmes, the servant he picked up on taking command of the division, struggled to get him to shelter. They then sat the battle out before striking out to get medical help. A bullet from a machine gun had passed clean through the back of his skull. Astonishingly, it missed everything necessary for life. The head wound didn't keep him off the battlefield for long, and in a perverse way, the bullet saved his life. That attack on Devil's Wood was very badly botched. Very few of the soldiers survived the night. On the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month of 1918, armistice was signed and the First World War came to an end. By this time, Adrian Carden de Weert had served in the battles of the Somme, Passchendaele, Cambrai, the Second Battle of Ypres, and Arras. At one point, he'd been temporarily promoted to Brigadier General. He collected a handful of medals and honours, including a Victoria Cross, the Belgian Croix de Guerre, and was appointed Companion of the Order of St. Michael and St. George in the King's Birthday's honours. The quick tally of his injuries. Adding to the shots to the stomach and groin, a lost eye, a badly mangled and eventually amputated hand, and a machine gun shot through the back of his head. He also caught a bullet in the hip at Passchendaele, got shot through the ankle at the Somme, got shot through the leg at Cambrai, and through the ear at Arras. Famously, when asked his thoughts on the horrors of the Great War, he said, "Frankly, I had enjoyed the war. It had given me many bad moments, lots of good ones, plenty of excitement." If anyone's curious, his worst memory of the war was the smell of putrefying bodies. Following the war, Adrian spent some time in Belgium, catching up with family, including his cousins Henry, a future Belgian Prime Minister, and Edmund, the political secretary to King Leopold II. Were we to stretch this out over a couple of episodes, it might be worth discussing his personal life at this point. That his father appears to have gone downhill fast following his bankruptcy. The sources describe something sounding like dementia. He died in the midst of the war. But we should quickly mention our hero had a wife and two children back home. The Countess Frederica von Babenhausen, and two daughters. He never really mentions them in his autobiography, but we are writing a boy's own adventure story. It's at this time, peacetime ennui sets in, and our hero craves an inciting incident to drive him on to his next big adventure. Their next big adventure came when General Louis Botha needed a second in charge for the British military mission to Poland. Adrian was dispatched alongside his servant Holmes. While the Great War put an end to several powerful empires, Poland seemed to be destined to move in the other direction. In 1569, the Poles, ruled by the ailing, childless Sigismund II, and the Lithuanians, constantly threatened with invasion by Russia, entered into a kind of democratic experiment. The two nations combined as the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth, a nation ruled semi-democratically by the large noble class. Rather than a president, they still had a king, but it was an elected position. And, unsurprisingly, there was little by way of democracy for the average Pole, although I gather it was still something more than an oligarchy in practice. The Commonwealth became one of the most powerful nations within Europe, but by the mid-17th century, things started to fall apart. Constant wars with their neighbours and internal strife amongst their many ethnic groups led to their long decline. The Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth was dissolved in 1795 after losing a war to Russia, and Poland was subsequently split up amongst the Prussians, Russians, and Austro-Hungarians. As is often the case, the Poles faced a century and a half of being prohibited from ruling themselves, or speaking their own language, or engaging in their own cultural practices. But as often also happens in these cases, there were plenty of brave souls who fought back against the colonizers with all their might. Try as they might, they never regained sovereignty, until granted it at the end of the war. With all three of those empires, Germany having superseded Prussia, in ruins, a resurgent Poland reformed itself following the war. However, this newfound freedom was under threat, specifically with the Russian Civil War on their doorstep, and by groups of Germans who were unwilling to give up fighting the Great War yet, and also by pretty much all of their neighbours, who were determined to take back some disputed borderland. For a man who quite frankly loved a good war, there was much to keep him occupied in Poland. By 1919, Poland were fighting five simultaneous wars against the Bolsheviks, Germans, Ukrainians, Lithuanians and Czechs, all to keep the independence promised them at Versailles. Adrian Carton de Weert was actively involved in all of those wars at one time or another. In his autobiography, he writes of regular train rides out to Warsaw to fight for Russians during the day, then getting on the train to enjoy regular civilian life in the evenings. Much of his time, however, was tied up in diplomatic work, trying to end wars and craft alliances against the growing communist threat. In two of these missions, he survived emergency or crash landings in planes. He became friendly with the Poles and a vocal supporter of their cause. Other tales emerge from his time in Poland, including one time when he acted as a second in a duel, in a gun-running scheme, bringing in wagon loads of weapons from Hungary that he got involved with. In 1924, with all five wars over, and Britain retreating from the region, Adrian Carton de Weert resigned from the forces to stay on in Poland. His friend, Prince Karol Mikołaj Radziwiłł, had inherited a large estate from an uncle who had been killed by the Bolsheviks. The grounds were huge, slightly bigger than Ireland in terms of acreage. The main property itself was badly run down, but was in the process of being renovated. The estate was in the Pripyat Marshes, just across the border from Russia. Adrian inquired as to how much it would cost him to rent a house on the estate. The prince replied, "For a friend, nothing." And so it was that Adrian Carton de Weert moved into a house on a grand estate called Prostin. He spent the following 15 years there, hunting every day on the ample grounds. From his description of life in those years, no mention if he was ever joined by his wife and daughters, his life was idyllic and peaceful. Out there in the middle of nowhere, in a community who welcomed him with open arms, Adrian lost track of the goings-on in the rest of the world. He'd only discovered the Great Depression had happened on one of his two trips back to England. On his second visit, King Edward VIII resigned, something all of Europe, barring the Pripyat Marshes, had been placing bets on for months. One couldn't blame him if the rise of fascism had escaped his attention. One shockwave that did reach him, however. On 30th of September 1938, Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain departed from a plane at London's Heston Aerodrome. He'd just come back from a meeting in Munich with Adolf Hitler. The Nazis were threatening to take Czechoslovakia's Sudetenland region, claiming practically all the people living there were German. Chamberlain went over to tell Hitler he was very unhappy. However, he came away with an empty promise of no further aggression from the Nazis. This was a promise that would be broken before the invasion of Poland, when they subsequently took Czechoslovakia's Bohemian and Moravian provinces in March 1939. In return for a soon-to-be-broken pact, Britain and France would let Hitler keep the Sudetenland. Later that day, from outside 10 Downing Street, he'd famously claimed the mission had brought peace for our time, echoing a speech Benjamin Disraeli made during the Congress of Berlin in 1878. Disraeli's speech concerned the ownership of the Balkan states, so neither man were accurate in their assessments. On hearing this news, Adrian realized Hitler would soon be coming after Poland, so he got in touch with the chief of staff of the British Army, Viscount Gort. He was ready and willing to put on his combat boots, but then he never heard back until July 1939. The War Office called him in to offer him the position of head of a British military mission to Poland. Days before the Nazis attacked, Adrian was called to Warsaw by Polish Commander-in-Chief, Marshal Edward Rijs Smigiel. They wanted his counsel. Carton de Weert suggested they master troops at the borders immediately and prepare to attack the Nazis with everything they had the moment they crossed the border. This advice was summarily ignored. He also told them to move the Polish navy out of the Baltic, as there was every likelihood the Nazis would capture it with little effort. Reed Smeagol grudgingly agreed to this point. On September 1, 1939, the Nazis invaded. They came in fast with tanks and planes, employing blitzkrieg tactics, a plan to fight a fast, heavily mechanized battle, which aimed to knock out the leadership and leave their opponents in a state of panic. Faced with a new face of war, Adrian Carton de Weert later commented, "With the first deliberate bombing of civilians, I saw the very face of war change. Bereft of romance, its glory shone, no longer the soldier setting forth into battle, but the women and children buried under it." A few days in, and it was clear the war was going the Nazis' way. It was also clear Britain were in no position at this stage to help the Poles. The success of a general named Kazimierz Sosnkowski in turning the Nazis back near Lviv, modern-day Ukraine, gave Adrian some hope the Poles could hold some ground within Poland. But Marshal Reed Smeagol made it clear he intended to run for the border. Adrian had approached him the day before to say if the Marshal chose to stay and fight, he would be there with him. But as it was, once the Russians became involved on September 17th, it was all over for the Poles. And the High Command hightailed it out to Bucharest, Romania. On arrival, they found Romania in a precarious state. Revolution was in the air, and the fascist Iron Guard were in the process of overthrowing the government of Armand Călinescu. False passports were arranged for them. They then fled to France by train. They left on September 21st, the day Prime Minister Călinescu was assassinated. In April 1940, Carton de Weert was given the command of a joint French-British force, deployed to Trondheim, Norway. The Nazis were making headway into Norway, which would have given them another angle to attack Britain from. In the months prior, Adrian had been working hard to get the 61st Division territorials ready to repel Nazis, should they land in the British Midlands. At risk of sounding ageist, this seemed more of a kind of role for a guy close to 60 years of age. At the time, the British military insisted no one over the age of 60 be sent off to fight an overseas war. But suddenly, they have this looming Norwegian problem. And one presumes they were short-handed, so he'd do. While flying from Scotland to Norway, their plane was nearly shot out of the sky by a German fighter. They had to emergency land, and one of his officers was badly injured. On arrival at Namsos, a bridgehead held by the Allies on the Namsen River, Adrian was struck by the rugged beauty of the snowy mountainous region. But as beautiful as it was, he was convinced it was far too precarious a place to defend. He moved the Norwegian Expeditionary Force closer to Trondheim, in preparation for a naval attack on the city. However, just a few days later, a German destroyer sailed up the fjord. The destroyer bombed the living daylights out of the expeditionary force. And then the plane showed up. Trapped in a small town, and incapable of completing their Trondheim mission, under relenting fire by gunboat and German bombers, the expeditionary force had no choice but to hunker down and await their rescue. They were in no position to fight back, to quote Carton de Weert. "We had rifles, a few Bren guns, and some 2-inch smoke bombs, but none of them were either comforting or effective against the destroyer." Eventually, Lord Mountbatten's ships broke through to rescue them. One ship, the French destroyer Afridi, was sunk in the escape. Adrian Carton de Weert commented, "He almost ended up on this ship, but for his gear being loaded onto the York," and half jokingly, he stated he'd been robbed of the experience of a shipwreck. On the voyage home, Adrian Carton de Weert turned 60, so his overseas adventures should really have come to an end. He was returned to his command of the 61st Territorial Division. From there, he moved on to Northern Ireland to get their home guard up to speed. But he was soon recalled, the top brass citing his age. All the same, he was soon sent back out as an advisor to Tito and the partisans in the Balkans. While flying a circuitous route that first took him to Malta, then a planned stop in Egypt, his plane's engines failed near the coast of Italian-controlled Libya. He was knocked out in the crash, and someone dragged him onto some floating wreckage. But when the wreckage sank, the survivors had no choice but to swim for the shore, where they were captured by Italian soldiers. As we haven't for a while, quick tally of injuries. Gunshot wounds to the stomach, the groin, twice in his eye, his hand, his hip, ankle, leg and ear. A machine gun shot him through the back of his head. Though he mentions no further gunshot injuries in his many Polish wars, he ditched in two planes, at least one of which could be classified as a crash. Further to that, he was in a plane which got shot up arriving in Norway and fell out of the sky en route to the Balkans. Kill rate? Still, who knows. Now, we're nearly at the end of Adrian Carton de Weert's, in his own words, happy odyssey. From 1941 to 1943, he was a prisoner of war at the Villa Medici in Abruzzi, Italy. As was expected of him, he made several plans to escape the camp. At one point, single-handedly digging a tunnel for 7 months. Just as he was finally making his great escape, orders came through to send him back to Britain by way of neutral Portugal. Conspicuous with his missing hand and eye, and not speaking a word of Italian, he all the same evaded capture for 8 days. Soon after his capture, he was shipped back to the UK. By all accounts, he was not terribly treated while in captivity, although he said he wished he'd run into a camp supervisor named Viviani, the implication being, if they met, Adrian would be apt to murder him. On 7th of September 1943, when Italy formally surrendered, the press leaked he'd been home for several months. This led to an inundation of letters from distressed parents asking if he had any word of their captured or missing children. Adrian hoped, the cat now out of the bag, he could still be sent out to Yugoslavia for one final hurrah. However, his friend, Winston Churchill, had different plans for him. Churchill sent him out to China as his personal representative. He travelled via Cairo, Egypt, where he was famously photographed alongside the Big Three, Churchill, Roosevelt, and Stalin, at the Cairo conference. In China, he was Churchill's eyes and ears. He got on quite well with the Kuomintang leader, Chiang Kai-shek. Chiang offered him a combat role, which he turned down. But he absolutely detested communist leader Mao Zedong. One night, he gave Chairman Mao a piece of his mind. From his desk job, he reported back any news from China, India, and Burma. Following the conclusion of the Second World War in Europe, Churchill was voted out. His successor, Clement Attlee, asked Adrian to stay on in the region. However, his military career came to an end in 1947, after falling down a flight of stairs in Rangoon, Burma. Though not paralyzed, he came a cropper, breaking his back and nearly breaking his neck. His final serious war wound would take several months to recover from. From Burma, he finally returned home to be with his family. His wife, the Countess, passed on in 1949, though he remarried to a woman 23 years his junior, named Joan Sutherland, not the opera singer. During his long military career, he saw warfare from cavalry attacks to trench warfare, to large-scale mechanized warfare, to the birth of the atomic age. Having served in the Boer War, he was writing memos back to England, predicting the coming of the Vietnamese War. Later in the year, we'll pick up our ongoing Infernal Machines series. We'll take a closer look at that atomic age. But for now, let's just leave Sir Adrian Carton de Weert, unkillable warrior, to his well-deserved retirement. Hunting and fishing every day on a County Cork estate, till he passed away in 1963, aged 83. Thank you for listening. This has been Tales of History and Imagination. All episodes written and narrated by me, Simone Whitlow. All music, yours truly. Visit the show at historyandimagination.com. You can follow me on social media, links in the show notes, and get access to exclusive bonus content via my Patreon, also in the notes. If you enjoyed the show, please leave a like on your podcatcher of choice and share the episode, as word of mouth is the best way to help shows like this grow. See you back in 2 weeks' time for more tales of history and imagination.